Today, the Vatican officially began investigating the life of Pope John Paul II in order to determine if he is worthy of sainthood, a process that normally begins 5 years after a person's death. We will talk about that today. Do you have questions about the process of becoming a saint? Would you like to see Pope John Paul canonized? We'd like to hear from you. Give us a call at 800-989-8255, 800-989-TALK, our email address, totn@npr.org. Here to tell us more about what it takes to become a saint is Ken Woodward. He's the author of Making Saints, and the religious editor for Newsweek magazine joins us from his home in Briarcliff Manor, New York. Welcome to the program, Ken.
Thank you.
Can you tell us a little bit about the canonization process?
Well, I can tell you a whole lot. I'll try to be brief. It's a discernment process, really, and it's to say that some people among the faithful have either as martyrs or non-martyrs, have become were exceptionally holy and therefore can serve as models for others to imitate and to venerate. It's the old idea of the French saints as friends of God. In the Catholic notion, Christ is never alone, but he's always sort of surrounded by his friends, typified
right.
by the Last Supper scene. So it's a discernment process, and it really begins among the people. I mean, let's take you for example. Let's supposing that Frank dies, and when he dies, people say, "Gee, that man was a holy man. He was really extraordinary." People might come out and visit your grave.
Never happened. Go ahead.
I understand. It doesn't happen to many of us. But somehow it helps not to think so much of a pope or someone above someone like ourselves, if we were so lucky to have been have exceptional holiness. So the reputation would develop among the people that knew him, and it might spread farther beyond. Obviously, with a pope, a international figure, it would be much larger, or Mother Teresa, for that matter. But just take an ordinary person, and the bishop where the person has died is sort of in charge, and they're supposed to sit back and watch this reputation for holiness develop. And does it develop over time? Till very recently, the 1980s, it would be 25 or 50 years they would let a reputation for holiness mature. Now it's down to 5 years. Mm-hmm. The legislation has changed. And at some point where this continues, and very often a guild or a group of people will voluntarily formed to promote a cause, as they have done with a number of people in the United States. So at a certain point, he says, this seems to be an ongoing thing, and he'll seek permission from the Vatican, the Congregation of Causes of Saints, to begin a process. And what they would do, Frank, is they would do two things. They would gather information about you. They would investigate your life. If you have a reputation for holiness, let's see if it's justified or is it just something in people's minds. And they would look at your letters. They would look whatever you've written. They would talk to your wife, if there is one, and friends and so forth to see if the reputation is justified. There's a man in the congregation. They would be assigned as a postulator to sort of guide this process. And they would also assign a relator who is going to figure a little bit later. And they would gather all this information about you. They would also hold tribunals where you lived. Say you live in Washington, but you were born in Kansas City and lived there, you know, a substantial period of time. And then you moved to Buffalo, and then you ended up in Washington. They would hold tribunals there.
And are they looking for particular? Are they looking for particular miracles, extraordinary events? Because it's already been determined by the number of people who've shown up at your grave over the years. They like you and they think you're holy. But
happening.
Now what?
They're, no, they're not. Not at this stage. Huh. They're not. That comes in later. Very often, what people will do is say, "I prayed to Frank, and Frank died of cancer, and my son's got cancer, and." By God, the cancer turned around, or whatever it may be, you know?
Yeah.
They're called divine favors at that point. And that guild that I mentioned would probably collect these stories because they're going to need them later. But they don't deal with that until they've gone through a different process. In any case, after investigating your life and holding tribunals and inviting people who didn't like Frank to come and say, no, I think this man, you know, this man really was a proud man. He was a he was harsh to his family or whatever it is. And this these testimonies would be brought together, and the relator would look over this material to see if whether there's a real good case could be made for Frank or not. And they would be, here's what they would be looking for. They would be looking for certain virtues, faith, hope, and charity, certainly, but also the old Aristotelian virtues, prudence, justice, fortitude, temperance, humility, because this is specifically, it's very much a Christian virtue, and perhaps obedience if you were in religious orders. And then they would form a panel of judges who would look at the material that the relator had put together in a positio, all the documentation. And he would write a sort of a introduction to say, this is why we think that we have a good case here.
Wow. So and, it really
be
sounds...
judged by a panel of judges. And if they found you heroically virtuous, you would be called venerable.
It's a, then, wow, this is really a process that is a long discernment process. They are taking their time and taking this process, obviously, very seriously.
50, 100, 200 years in the past.
So what happens? So tell us about what happens in Rome today when this process gets underway, albeit the truncated process now. What happens on day one? What happened today in Rome?
What happens today in Rome?
Yeah.
Well, just what I'm describing to you. I mean, even with somebody like John Paul II, it's going to take an enormous amount of time, even though they've sort of jump-started it. But what they would do afterwards is they would have collected these stories of divine favors, and they would look at them and say, are some of these genuinely miracles?
Yeah.
And they would look at, usually there's a lot of, x-rays. Most of these things take place in hospitals, so there's doctors to be interviewed. And they want to know from them whether, and usually it's an inexplicable cure. And so they would ask them about that, what was the prognosis and what was the diagnosis and so forth. And then this, too, would be judged. And once a had a miracle, you would be declared blessed by the Pope. And then after that beatification, you need another miracle before you can be canonized a saint of the Church. That, in short course, is what takes place.
Well, that's an amazing process. 800-989-TALK. We're talking today about the canonization process that began today for John Paul II. It began in Rome. It is a much shorter version of that process that took place over the 2,000 years of the Church's history. Greg is on the line in San Diego. Hello, Greg.
Hello. I feel that this is a product of the immediate post-funeral sorrow among some people. Pardon the expression, but it's kind of a rush to judgment. I know that it can take decades, centuries, and so forth, but to begin it this quickly is potentially going to start a backlash. Well, he wasn't that good. He doesn't deserve to be a saint. And, I don't know if it serves any really good purpose right now. In my opinion, I had the greatest respect for the man. I disagreed with some of his positions, but in reading about his life, reading the writings that he composed, I think he truly, and the effect that he had on geopolitics, I think he was truly the greatest, one of the greatest of the 20th century, both in the temporal realm and in worldly ways, and certainly as spiritual leader.
Hmm. But you're saying that this is really happening too fast, even for a good man.
And I think, as I say, it runs the threat of people having a backlash against the whole idea of sainthood, of it being trivialized. There are saints from the 14th century who have just been, it started back then, but it did take 400 or 500 years. And I think people may, get a more trivialized sense of the idea of sanctity and sainthood.
Well, let's get a response. Let me get a response from that much from Ken Woodward, who's been covering this kind of thing. I mean, what accounts for this? Is just this the general speed up of modernity? Things are just moving. Everything's moving faster these days. So is canonization, Ken?
No, really. The roots of it are in Vatican Council II, putting more responsibility on the local bishop and the local church. That's why it's the local bishop who starts all of this. But a part of it also was it was taking too long. I mean, there are an awful lot of people from those previous centuries that people in the church today have forgotten. So the idea was that having more contemporary figures of the saint as someone who, in yet a new way, has been an extraordinary disciple of Christ, that is better to get those out in front of people. There are some people who are on the Vatican's list who have still lack a miracle, and nobody's going to bother with them anymore. I mean, they're centuries old. So that was the reason. And the other thing was they abolished the office of the devil's advocate or the promoter of the faith. In the past, it was an adversarial process with lawyers on both sides, and this very often could take the going back and forth between these two sides could draw it out for decades and indeed for centuries. So in that sense, it was speeded up when they got rid of that process. Now it's more like a PhD dissertation. Mm. And the relator, and you'll be talking to one, I understand, an excellent one, relator is to really judge this to see if all the material is there and a case is made. But it's a faster process. But it's still, I would think, even with this pope, I understand what your caller is saying, and I would tend to want to slow all of these down as much as possible. During Vatican Council II, by the way, the bishops gathered there wanted to forego the process altogether and proclaim John the 23rd a saint, seeing what the extraordinary response to him throughout the world through all the newspapers.
We are talking today about the canonization process that got underway today in Rome for Pope John Paul II. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. I'm Frank Stacio in Washington with my guest Ken Woodward, author of Making Saints Inside the Vatican, Who Becomes Saints, Who Do Not, and Why. Is there a sort of a pattern? Has it changed over time? Can we tell a lot about the church in any particular era by the saints that have been chosen?
I think you can, but you have to keep at a distance. Yes, there's been... and I talk about that in the book. There have been varying styles in spirituality. Some would go out of fashion, and indeed, some people who were still working on a candidate's cause would rewrite their life to reflect sort of the new spirituality. But that's very much in the past. But yes, you and social scientists, if you will, have studied these patterns to see what they. What the saints who are chosen say about the times and the lives of the saints, even if they may be full of legend, are a rich trove of understanding life in the Middle Ages.
Let's go to the phones. Kathy is on the line from Wisconsin. Hi, Kathy.
Yes, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
Well, you partially answered my question regarding beatification and canonization, but I was wondering now, since medical science has obviously progressed an awful lot in the last 100 years, isn't it much harder to get the requisite 2 miracles for canonization now?
There's Ken Woodward.
That's a very good question and a very insightful one. And the answer is yes, it is, in part because if you live in a privileged medical situation like such as many people do in the United States, you'll have a team of doctors working on you. And what they want from the doctors to say is there's no medical explanation. That means many more people have to sign off. They don't say it's a miracle. That's not their province. They simply say we don't have an explanation for this. They have theologians that look at it to decide whether, inexplicable cure can be miraculous. And I would add this, too, that it should be obvious, but most of the doctors who are involved in these processes aren't Catholic.
Right.
Most doctors aren't Catholic. And your call very often to Rome to explain their medical opinions.
Thanks for the call, Kathy. Of course, the other side of that is if you do prove a miracle, or you suggest that, if you call it a miracle these days in the age of science, it's really a miracle.
Well,
the perception.
I'm at the point to argue that it seems to me
the
that
perception would
talking
be
talking about a church that believes in the God who isn't handicapped and therefore can and doesn't have intervened in human affairs. But I would say about the culture of the church with respect to miracles is that on the one hand, they vigorously affirm that miracles can and do happen, but they're highly almost rationalistic in their demands to prove that it happened in this particular instance.
Is the church, the criticism of the church throughout its history about saints has been that it is really a form of idolatry and that they've had to fend off this criticism for the better part of 2,000 years?
Well, that really comes from the Reformation. The first thing to go in the churches of Europe where the Reformation took hold were the statues, and then of course the altar. So that today at a Billy Graham crusade, you won't see statues, you don't even see an altar. They have an altar call. That's a criticism that can be made, and I think in a lot of pious people. I mean, there's the old joke: you go down the street in Rome and ask the first person you meet, "Do you believe in God?" And he says, "No, but Mary is his mother." I think the church has been aware of that, and at Vatican II, they try to put the focus back on Christ. After all, the saint glorifies Christ as being a disciple of Christ, not the other way around. But people do tend to attach themselves to particular saints with whom they feel particularly comfortable, saying, "I've prayed to you, Saint Anthony. I need my husband's a drunkard."
One miracle we cannot do on this program, Ken, I'm afraid, is create time. Thank you very much, Ken Woodward, author of The Making of Saints Inside the Vatican, for talking with us about canonization. I'm Frank Stacio, NPR News in Washington.